David Hinchcliffe, thank you so much for joining us on Interview with an Artist this morning. You started painting when you were 12. Were your parents creative?
Yes, both of them. But Dad was very specifically creative in the artistic painterly department. He painted as a young man, which was a fairly rare thing for a kid growing up in provincial Queensland. He painted in oils, and he painted when he was 13, 14, 15, won some competitions at the local agricultural shows. He mostly did copies of famous artworks, and he did a few portraits along the way. The paintings that I cherished the most in my very large collection are the paintings that I have of Dad's. They're absolutely beautiful because of the special meaning that they have for me. So he stopped painting at the age of 15 when he took up his cadetship at his father's newspaper, and he went on to have a career in journalism, as my grandfather did. I was trained as a journalist. My brother was a journalist. So journalism is the strong bloodline that runs through our family.
You joined politics in 1988 and had quite an extensive and very successful career. Were you still painting in your spare time?
Never put down the brush.
Okay.
From the age of 12, I was painting and selling paintings. My very first painting was done in a competition. They used to have what were referred to in Queensland as fence painting competitions. We didn't paint fences. We painted on boards, MDF, or what they call back then Masonite boards, that were attached to fences and during the day. And then at the evening, they auctioned the paintings. They gave a prize for first, second, and third. And it was a great way for amateur artists to paint with professional artists. So at the age of 12, I was hanging out with really cool dudes who were, you know, fully fledged artists. It was real bohemia. These people drank wine, for example. That was unheard of in the Brisbane of the 60s. Everyone else drank beer. And, of course, a 12-year-old, I wasn't drinking, but I was at least sort of sitting on the edge of this very bohemian scene. So when I got involved in politics, I continued to paint, usually at weekends or more often just on holidays, because the job of politics is an all-consuming one, and about the only time you get free is around about holiday time, when you can sort of head out of the city, out of the electorate, and take up the canvas and the easel.
In 2011, you resigned from politics full-time and took up painting full-time. Tell us about that feeling.
Well, I was nervous about leaving elective office after 25 years. There are a lot of politicians who have painted. I mean, you only have to look at World War II. They all painted back in World War II. I think Stalin was the only one who didn't paint. Hitler, famously, was a failed artist. Churchill painted. And Eisenhower painted. So a lot of politicians have picked up the brush over the years, but as amateur artists, there aren't too many who have turned a political career into an artistic career. But I had been painting, as I said, through my life in politics, so it wasn't such a big leap. The gallery that had been representing me in Brisbane closed down the year that I gave up politics. Another gallery asked me to join their stable, and I've since become their biggest selling artist, which is lovely. But what I think has more than anything else established my international career is landing a gallery in New York. And once I did that, my international career really took off. So I'm now represented in London, New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore. And that's I still can't quite believe how it's happened. And I'm very grateful for the fact that it has happened.
Interestingly, what differences do you see in the groups who consume or acquire your art in the different countries? Is there do the Americans like a different style of painting to the people in Hong Kong? Do you sell different works in London?
That's a very good question. And I think I'm probably at a stage of, in my evolution as a producer of art where I can probably answer that. 10 years ago, I wouldn't have had any idea. Certainly, I can say, for example, in London, I basically paint the portraits of cities. I am in politics, I was very much an urban politician. I represented an inner city seat. I loved the city. I was immersed in the city. I painted the city, and I continue to paint the cities of the world. And I try not to paint them too realistically. I want to paint them with passion. I try to evoke the atmosphere or the mood or the impression of the city that I'm painting. In the case of New York, of course, New Yorkers love New York, but they don't like certain parts of New York. For example, you cannot sell a painting of Times Square to a New Yorker. The reason is they think that Times Square is fake. It looks like Disneyland to them. And so they will buy paintings of downtown New York or paintings that are generically sort of urban. But if it looks too much like you're painting Times Square, they'll say, no, that looks like the sort of painting the tourists buy. And they won't do that. So when I'm painting Times Square, those paintings will be paintings that people who have been to New York, people in London or Brisbane or Sydney or Melbourne, who all regard New York as their second city. I think for many people around the world, New York is their second sort of second city. And they will buy the paintings that represent New York, like Times Square. Londoners, not so attached to New York, but they love London. And so I paint a lot of London paintings in London. Obviously, every city loves itself. They love to see itself and themselves reflected in paint. And I try to do it in a way that perhaps is a little bit different from how others have done it. There's no point in me trying to replicate the work of others. There are so many great artists in the world, and the last thing I want to do is just ape what someone else has done. And it's very hard to come up with something new. So I'm always striving to get a slightly different take. When I first went to New York and was looking for a gallery, I had no luck at all. I had two trips to New York before I landed a gallery. And the way I landed it was by going through to a life study class, a group. It wasn't a class, it was a group. The Spring Street Studio, which I think is still around, in Spring Street in Soho. It's run by this amazing woman who calls herself Minerva, after the goddess. And I'd been going there quite a bit, sketching my heart out day in, day out, because I was feeling a little bit disconsolate about not being able to get a gallery interested in my work. And at one stage I said, look, can you help me? Minerva. And she said, well, show me your work. So I went online, I showed her the sort of stuff that I did. I had a website. And she said, I think you should speak to Michael. And I said, who's Michael? She said, Michael Ingber. He's around the corner down the street. He's on Broadway. So I went down. And like every other gallery, the moment I walked in the door and said I was an artist, they said, not interested. they said, we're doing it tough. We don't want artists. We want buyers. And I said, well, Minerva sent me down. The moment I said Minerva had sent me down, Michael Michael's shoulders slumped, and he said, "Oh, okay, yeah, I better do Minerva a favour and at least see your portfolio." So he went online, had a look, and he turned to me and said, "How about April next year?" And that's how I got my first show in New York through Minerva. Now, a lot of artists, I think just about every artist, need that moment of pure, undiluted luck to get their careers moving. And from that point on, one piece of luck was followed by a second piece and a third and a fourth. London Gallery saw my work in New York and invited me over, et cetera, et cetera. And it just leads to so many things. My dealer in Tokyo saw all of my work online, and I deal directly with him. He actually buys my work wholesale, and then he distributes it around Japan. And the Japanese taste is quite different from the taste in other countries. The Japanese, more than any other community that I deal with, I have very different tastes and approach, or at least my dealer does. He's quite specific.
It's a very distinctive style that they like and taste that they have.
Yeah, and a different way of approaching a painting. He has said to me, I've had a couple of shows over there, as well as sending in a lot. I would have sent in quite a few paintings over the years. He said, "Now, this is how a Westerner looks at a painting," and he stands about a metre to 2 metres away from the painting. "Now, this is how a Japanese buyer looks at a painting," and then he gets his nose about 6 inches away from the painting. He says, "Japanese people want to see the detail. They want to get right up close and see what's gone into the painting, whereas others," he says, "see the bigger picture." And look, he's been a dealer for decades, probably about four or five decades. So I think he does know the Japanese psyche and market much better than I would. So I have to accept what he says is true. So I've got a much better idea what works and what doesn't. And you've got to be very careful as an artist about getting that information, because then, armed with that information, it may change the way you paint. And you've got to be very careful about not allowing the market to dictate what you paint. You've got to be mindful of it, but not dictated by it.
It's interesting you say that. The artist, Eliza Goss, she was like, "If I painted pink..." She has a focus on architectural, mid-century architecture. And she said, "If I painted pink houses, they fly off the shelves."
Yeah.
And we were talking about that commercial creative tension that an artist feels, knowing that, well, that's a piece that will sell really well or really easily, but is that true to what this creative venture is about?
Yes. Look, I think I can see both sides of the picture. Certainly galleryists will say, you know, they know exactly what they want. They know what the market... They're dealing with the market every day, and they're listening to people say, "Yes, I like that, but, you know, if it was pink, I'd buy it, but it's not pink, it's blue," or whatever. I can tell you now that my blue paintings are the ones that sell the best. Paintings with umbrellas. I've done a lot of paintings of rain. I'm fascinated by rain. Part of that came about in New York too. When I finally had that exhibition at Ingmar Gallery, I was really getting quite desperate. I've been in New York. I have a studio in Harlem, and I had been wrestling with how I was going to do New York in a slightly different way from everyone else. And as I was walking not far from Times Square, the clouds came over, the rain came down. All of the detail of the city just literally dissolved in the rain, and this beautiful fog and mist descended over the city. And instead of seeing all of that detail, it just blended into each other. And so you had these beautiful silhouettes of people with umbrellas scurrying around like Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, just these beautiful little musical notes on legs, and reflected in the pavement below because of all the rain and water that was on the ground. And out of that mist came this woman. I remember as clearly as the day I first saw her, dressed in very New York red with a black umbrella. And I thought, okay, that's an image that is so powerful. I've been painting people with umbrellas, little symphonies of umbrellas, on and off ever since then. And the umbrella paintings just walk out the door. But I don't want to just paint umbrellas. So I'm doing lots of other work. But I do know that if I paint a certain way and a certain subject, then I'm guaranteed those paintings will sell. It's a very tempting piece of information, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I can imagine it is. What do you do to get out of a creative funk?
Yeah, well, I don't have too many. I paint, I mean, touch from the last few days because I've just had an operation on my eye. I paint every day, and I don't feel that I need to be inspired to paint. I think there's a lot of rubbish talked. For me, it's rubbish. It may not be rubbish for other people, so I should be careful about describing it so pejoratively. I think there's this notion, this romantic notion, that artists are these delicate creatures that have to be be inspired, that have to have creativity teased out of them by some sort of metaphysical transcendental state. Whereas, in fact, I think art is in me and I've got to get it out. I've got to keep painting. I love the idea that through my hands I can pick up a brush, put it in paint, put it onto a canvas, and it starts and turns it into something. I find that alchemy, that chemistry, absolutely fascinating. And I've never lost the fascination of being able to turn those simple elements of brush, paint and canvas into something that people seem to appreciate. So I enjoy the act of painting. The only thing that would prevent me from painting is not a sort of creative block, but a physical block. So, for example, the physical block I've got now, I can't see. If there's some physical impediment that stops me painting, well, then I won't. But so long as I can paint, I will. I don't need to be inspired to do that.
Do you remember the first piece you sold?
Oh, yes, I do. I was painting in the west end of Brisbane. It was outside the Tristram factory. Tristram was a bottle company that made soft drink and very popular in Queensland. And they were located there. And it was one of those fence painting competitions. I was in year seven at primary school. And I was given this board and some paint. I had brushes, I think. And so I painted away, and it was there was, I know there was a horse in it. I know there was some sort of tortured figure. Back in the 60s, our national identity was very much rural. You know, although 80% of Australians lived in the cities, we still had this notion that we were from the country, that we were part of the country. Most of us had never seen the outback, but we had this idea that we were born under a gum tree and we're riding horses by the age of, you know, 6 months. The facts were quite different. So a lot of my imagery, I think, at the time was that was around horses and country and all that sort of stuff. So I think there was a horse in it. I'm not sure about everything else. I'm sure there would have been red and yellow and orange because they were big colours of the 60s. Anyway, I painted it and it was sold at auction for around about $20. My father, who was chief of staff of the Courier Mail, was getting about $35 a week at the time. And here was his 12-year-old son getting more than half of his salary in one painting.
Oh, my goodness.
It was quite a revelation. So from that point on, every weekend, I'd be going to these fence painting competitions. And I had a terrific childhood. I was obviously going to school, but on weekends, I was living this other life with these this bohemian crowd.
These wine drinkers.
Wine drinking. And they used to hang out at my place. Mum and Dad were very, very young. Mum and Dad had me when they were 18 and 19. So they were more like big brother and big sister. And they were around about the age of the people that I was painting with. So I sort of was on the edge of this really very exciting, inspired, creative crowd. And that's what got me going.
So, David, it sounds like you had passion and you had talent. How do you end up in politics?
Well, it's not that strange. I know a lot of people think that you can't imagine two careers more diametrically opposed. I think politics needs more creative people.
Yes, I would agree with you there.
I also think that they're not mutually exclusive. I found I approached politics in a very creative way. I have the sort of brain that sees problems slightly differently from a lot of my other colleagues. And I didn't realise this until I was sitting down with them on a regular basis, looking at these issues, and I would be the one who would come up with, hey, what about this? And I think that's what's important about the creative arts and how they need to be integrated into not just politics, but into other areas of economic activity and professional activity. Far too often, we compartmentalise. I'm a great believer in learning from Indigenous culture in a whole variety of ways. There is an assumption in Indigenous culture that everyone can sing, everyone can paint. This is traditional Indigenous culture. And we don't see things that way. We compartmentalise people and say, okay, you are the painter, you are the doctor, you are the politician. And the reality is we would be far better if we were sort of crossing over those schools more regularly, if we had more artists involved in the process, for example, of planning our cities. So at one stage I was chairman responsible for development and planning in Brisbane, and we did get artists involved in the process, not simply to create nice paintings on the sides of buildings, but to see things in a more aesthetic way and to look at problems in a more creative way. So they weren't painting paintings, but they were applying the brain, that part of the brain that makes them an artist, they were applying to the problem of planning and coming up with solutions that were a little bit different. So I think that, I don't see them as being mutually exclusive. I've always felt the need for reform. I've felt that society is improving. We can always do better. And I felt I wanted to be part of that move for change and improvement. And I, as much as I loved art, and love painting. This is going to be very controversial, but no painting has ever changed the world. None. A lot of my artist friends disagree when I say that, but no painting has changed the world. Even a painting, for example, like Picasso's Guernica, it didn't stop the Spanish Civil War. It didn't stop the Second World War from starting. It was a powerful emotional response to the bombing of that town in Spain. And it made a lot of people cry and feel very emotional. But it didn't change the world, didn't change the course of history. Politicians do. Politicians are capable of making the world a better place. We focus on the worst things that politicians can do, but they can do a lot of good if they put their mind to it. And I just think that we need more good people to put their hand up for a pretty hard job in politics. It's getting harder and harder because the focus of attention is more and more on our politicians, on everything they do and say, and it makes it very hard for them to do or say anything because it's being ripped apart, word by word, second by second.
Yeah, I was going to say every second of the day.
Absolutely, absolutely. Very hard job, but someone's got to do it, and hopefully the better people will do it. The trouble with the system at the moment is it gets the worst out of people, not the best.
Mm.
And there are so many good people who go into it with the best of intentions. And it's not because they're bad people that they end up doing bad things. The system doesn't encourage the best out of people. But that's a different subject for another day.
Yeah. And so when did you start calling yourself an artist?
That's another good question. I have not called myself an artist until the last few years. And I think that's partly cultural, partly personal. The cultural aspect is at school, I hated the thought that any of my schoolmates called me an artist. And if they did, it was usually a term of derision. You're the artist, they would say, because I used to win awards and things that would be in the newspaper. And I would dread that, absolutely dread it. All I wanted to be was normal and average and blend into the background. So when they started, when they would call me an artist, I would feel humiliated. So I didn't call myself an artist for a very long time. And only recently have I called myself an artist because I felt it was a bit pretentious. I felt there were too many people who call themselves an artist who weren't really artists. And I didn't want to do that. And only recently, when I changed my passport and they had profession, I thought, well, it's around about time now that I should say I'm an artist.
Yeah, you're legit.
I'm legit, yeah. I've hated the idea of that's an Australian characteristic too, pretentiousness. We hate pomposity. We hate pretentiousness. We hate tall poppies. And I felt calling yourself an artist was a bit pretentious. But now it'd be silly not to call me an artist because that's clearly what I do.
It would be very silly not to call you an artist. I know. Who is your biggest fan?
My biggest fan is also my biggest critic. That's my father.
Oh, tell us more.
Okay. Well, Dad, as I said, painted when he was very young. And Dad has he believes in rules. Now, we know that the 20th century shredded every single rule in art. Rules about perspective, verisimilitude, all of those traditional rules about perspective and the composition of paintings, all of those were shredded. You know, you had abstractionism, expressionism, surrealism. All of those things basically said by the end of the 20th century, there really aren't any rules. But Dad likes to still take a ruler over a painting and say, you haven't got your perspective right on this, or that figure is too big, is bigger than the figure over there, and they're on the same plane. Or he will analyze something in terms of its whether it's technically correct or not. And while that shouldn't matter, and while I object to what he says, he's usually right. So when he's left the room, I usually fix it up. But he also is just wonderful. He comes to all my shows. He's come to my New York shows. He's been a wonderful source of inspiration. When he turned 80, 5 years ago, he said something that inspired me and will continue to. He said, "I have never been as happy as I am today." Now, for an 80-year-old to get up and say that makes you think, well, I've got some more years to look forward to.
Yeah, life keeps going, doesn't it?
It does. Not everyone takes that view. Not everyone says, a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, my best days were in my 20s or my 30s. And here he's saying his best days are in his 80s. And he's proving that to be right.
He must be very proud of you.
Well, if he is, the feeling is mutual.
Oh, that is so lovely. That is so lovely. Other than a piece of work by your father, because I know you spoke earlier about that really kind of calling to you, what mm-hmm. other piece of art or work have you seen throughout your creative career that's really stuck with you?
Well, at a very early age, I was deeply affected by the work of Francis Bacon. And most of the artists who I really respect and admire and this work I love, you can't see their work in mine, at least not on the surface. But Francis Bacon, I think, was just one of the titans of the 20th century. I feel his expressionist gestural approach to figures in agony. They're visceral. Visceral is a very good word, I think, to use in relation to Francis Bacon. I love the draftsmanship of someone like David Hockney, for example. But Bacon is the one who's got the real power behind him. That's in terms of 20th century artists. I'm not a big fan of Pollock or Rothko. I certainly admire abstraction. I can't do it. I always, whenever I put paint on a canvas, I'm always shaping it into some form. It might be just an impression of a form, but it nevertheless is a form. In terms of Australian painters, well, everyone loves Ben Quilty. And Ben has some of the characteristics I think I spoke of in relation to Francis Bacon. If Francis Bacon were alive in the 21st century, he'd probably be painting more like Ben Quilty. Now that I think about it, those two would be soulmates, although they have quite different different personalities. I'd say they're my biggest. They would be among the biggest of my artistic gods. It's one of those things, isn't it? Whenever you ask what's your favourite piece of music, you'd be lost. There are so many, and there are so many great artists. But
they're the kind of obvious ones. Yeah, they're the kind of ones that stick out at the moment.
Well, the work that Quilty has done, I think the pieces for me that stand out by far are the massacre pieces that he has produced, which are beautiful on the outside and tragic on the inside. They are massive, magnificent pieces of landscape. And then you realise these are the trees and the lakes where the souls of massacred people lie. And that, I think, is one of the most powerful statements in Australian art, because we have a lot of unresolved issues in relation to First Nation people and those who have come after. people like me. So I think an artist who is able to address issues like that has to be acknowledged.
Acknowledged. Yeah.
Thank you. I was going to say put on a pedestal. No, you don't want to put him on a pedestal. You want to acknowledge him, and you want to try to understand what he's saying or attempting to say in these works. So I think that's very powerful. His stuff when he was a war artist in Afghanistan is really important too. He addresses issues about masculinity and the tension between that and war. But I think where, for me, what resonates most powerfully are those massacre paintings. They're beautiful and tragic at the same time.
Last question. Where would you like to see your work in a couple of years' time?
Stylistically, I'm trying to break it down. I've been looking for the right word, and I haven't yet got the right word yet, but for want of a better word, I want to atomize what I'm doing. I want to break it down.
Deconstruct
will mean something different to other people.
Okay.
Deconstruct is another word that comes to mind. I want to pull it apart and make it look less about what it is so that you have to work a little bit harder to interpret it.
Mm.
I'm a great believer, and I say this with all of my students when I do workshops, don't fill in all the detail. Let other people fill the detail in because they will do a better job. It's a bit like comparing a book and a movie. Sure, movies can be very exciting and they can have their special effects and all sorts of things. But in a book, your imagination is filling a lot of that stuff in. And so many people will read a book, then they'll see the movie and they'll say, what a disappointment, because they had imagined it in a different way. I think there is a very powerful element of imagination that we ought to enable when we paint something. If you fill in every detail, then there's no effort required of the viewer. If you leave something out, if you blend in and let them fill in with the third eye of imagination, I think it'll mean more to them, and they'll probably see in it more than you put in it. So I'm trying to atomize, to disintegrate my paintings, to deconstruct them a bit. So that's probably where I'd like to see them stylistically.
David Hinchcliffe, thank you so much for your time this morning. It has been really fantastic speaking with you for Interview with an Artist.
It's been my pleasure, I can assure you.
Thanks, David. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.